I gave you a little kind of a commentary before the reading itself. I'm not going to read the commentary, but just the reading, because I think we talked about some of the dynamics of love before, and love is the bottom line of Christianity. That's basically, Jesus says, if you love, you fulfill all the commandments. So this was a thought that kind of expands our understanding of what it means to love. Traditionally, Homer was blind. The great artists have gained their wholeness through their wounds, their epilepsies, tuberculoses, periods of madness. My son-in-law, Alan Jones, told me a story of a Hasidic rabbi renowned for his piety. He was unexpectedly confronted one day by one of his devoted youthful disciples. In a burst of feeling, the young disciple exclaimed, "My master, I love you." The ancient teacher looked up from his books and asked his fervent disciple, "Do you know what hurts me, my son?" The young man was puzzled. Composing himself, he stuttered, "I don't understand your question, Rabbi. I'm trying to tell you how much you mean to me, and you confuse me with irrelevant questions." "My question is neither confusing nor irrelevant," rejoined the rabbi. "For if you do not know what hurts me, how can you truly love me?" Would anyone like to share a thought?
I don't know. I hope I'm not too far off base on this, but I found that growing up, everybody gets dropped on our heads. Let's face it, everybody has something. You know, everybody either has grown up and been abused, whether it be psychological, physical abuse, or something. In some shape or form, we've all felt something. And people who have felt something the deepest all turned out to be artists, musicians. They've turned out to be woodworkers. They've all turned out to, and that's the way to express themselves, to get themselves out of it. There's so many people that hurt in different ways. They may turn to knitting or whatever it may be, book writing, or you know, scrapbooks. But the thing is that everyone has something that's deep inside that they need to get out. And a lot of times people just don't take the time to understand that we've all been dropped, and we all can need the benefit of the doubt that you're hurting too. And so often we just think of ourselves.
Talk about being dropped. I was dropped on my head when I was a kid. That's my problem. My sister did it. She's not here to defend herself, so.
When I know somebody, if I know that that person has a wonderful soul, I love them. It doesn't, I think that's all I have to say. I can't, I mean, I know I've loved people that have passed, and people say, "Do you know this about them, or do you know that about them?" And that's from people in the church. And I just, that's how I feel.
Good. Thank you. No, to your point too, Tony, a lot of comedians become comics to kind of get over their hurts.
I didn't think I had anything to say, but the one thing that comes out of this is that I feel like I like and have compassion, but I don't love. Love is too extreme, I guess.
Good. You're good. Yes, my dear.
So basically what the three of you are saying, you're talking about the love part, that's which is really great, but what I have a problem with is, in order to love to be able to have that balance. How much are you going to hurt the person to find out how much you love that person? Or what are you going to do when that person hurts tons? And how much are you going to be there?
Looking at it from the receiving end. Anybody else?
When I read stuff like that, it always takes me back to retail land. And yeah, just because, and it's not just because I work in retail, but because I represent the business. When people come in, we have lovely people, and we have people who are just almost intolerable, who come in, and I would not say love, but I have to sort of, I have to assume that there's something about them that I don't know that's making them the way they are, and I have to treat them with a dignity, which I would say instead of love, with a dignity, no matter what.
I was in retail myself for a long time, on the jewelry industry, and there was a young man came in, and he was interested in buying a diamond. And he came in, he was a probably 30-something, younger 30, and he came in and he had kind of a chip on his shoulder already. And I said, what can I show you? What can I help you out with? And everything. He said, I'm interested in a diamond, but it has to be this, this, and this, and this, and this. I said, okay. I said, how did you arrive at that so I could help you? Well, that's what I found on the internet. Okay. I said, well, let's see what I could find. Went inside the case. I found a diamond that was very close to it. He said, well, you're going to have to sharpen your pencil. I says, excuse me? I says, this is the best that I could do. I said, let's face it, we're all in, you know, trying to make a living. And he says, well, I'm sorry, if the internet can do that, so can you. I said, I'm afraid I can't help you. And I closed the case and got up and walked away. And he just sat there stunned, and he walked out the door. 15 minutes later, 20 minutes later or so, he walked back in, and he says, I'm terribly sorry, I owe you an apology. And I said, well, no apology is necessary, but what seems to be troubling you? He says, well, so many people told me that I have to be careful of jewelers because they rip you off. I says, well, that's not necessarily true. I says, this store that I'm in right now has been around for many years. And I says, they haven't been in around for many years because they haven't been ripping people off. So, you know, what, you know, so I says, I'm sorry that I couldn't help you. So he says, no, I want you to help me because you were the first person that said to me, that actually reacted to me. And my reaction to him was actually like it shattered all that feeling that he had, all that negative feeling. And he says, and you were being honest with me. And he said, and you told me that you were just trying to make a living. I says, that's true. Ended up selling him a diamond. But the moral of the story is that I had to get on the other side of him.
Anyone else?
I just had, I don't understand, I'm just baffled by the last sentence that if you do not know what hurts me, how can you truly love me? So what's the time frame for discovering or finding out what hurts a person? You know, is it a day, a week, a lifetime? Maybe you'll never know. So that sentence bothers me because it's saying literally, if you take it literally, that you can't love me until you know more about me, and I just don't think that's right. And I think, I know there's a lot of famous artists, musicians, whatever, painters, literature, who have major neuroses and have done great things, but I think in terms of humanity, everyone is in the same condition. You may not have an obvious talent or whatever, but everyone struggles with human relations. So I think that should be looked at too. And I think that just because someone has a talent doesn't mean there's a neurosis behind it that makes it manifest. I think that someone could be blessed with a talent, share it beautifully, and be normal or whatever, not have the result of a neurosis. So just my thought on that.
Very good thought. Anyone else?
In coming back to that, Alan, it's when you said that kind of reminds me of I hate this. Okay, but basically what I'm saying is when you have like a couple or really supposedly really best friends and one won't say what really hurts them, there are a lot of times when as the years go by, you have the person that really cares gets tired of the non-speaking or the abuse and just leaves. The person that never said what was wrong from the very beginning possibly never wants to be loved. And that's...
There are a lot of different ways to take this. But have you ever heard the expression, "He knows how to push my buttons"? That's a very common phrase, but it describes something that through years of listening to people and confessions and counseling and doing marriage therapy and family therapy, one of the things that's true of all of us is that, you know, it's generically true that every one of us is formed by the world around us, which happens to be where we are born. And there's no such thing as an ideal family. There's no such thing as an ideal upbringing. There's no such thing as perfect. Every one of us are flawed. And I know I look at my parents. I understood them as a kid and obeyed everything they said. When I became a teenager, I wasn't so sure. When I was in college, I knew, definitely. They didn't have a clue of what was going on. And so I had to be on my own. But I realized growing up, too, that my parents were my parents because of their parents, and their parents were their parents because of their parents, and on and on and on, all the way back to Adam and Eve. And that strain helps us to understand that when we try to get together as people, strangers, we come together for the first time as strangers, there's a huge dynamic that's taking place. And after doing a lot of therapy with people and listening, you can tell by the way a person responds that there's something there. You can see what a person does behaviorally and not definitely point the finger and say, aha, but to say that there's some turmoil here, there's some inner struggle that's taking place, et cetera, et cetera. Now, when you're dealing with marriage or you're dealing with relationships, it becomes a real important issue because unless I really know what your button is and you trust me with that, there's a whole part of you that I don't know. And most of us don't really get to that point in many relationships, at least not friendships. But hopefully in a love relationship, there's an element of willingness to kind of be vulnerable in that way. That's the only way that there can be love, is if I'm vulnerable to the person, because unless Louise knows where I have been, what I have been through, how I have internalized the experiences of my life, and therefore how it affects my behavior, she's going to be second-guessing every time I do something and try to figure out what's the problem here. And if there's no answer, pretty soon she starts thinking she's the problem. And she's not the problem. I'm the problem with my inability to say and show and tell and trust and be vulnerable in a way that's going to allow her to understand who I really am. And if I don't do that for her, she has no choice but to look at me and say, I love you, yeah, but I don't hear that because I know she doesn't know a whole part of me. That's the hard reality about this. And why we're talking about this, not to get into marriage therapy and all that kind of stuff, but that dynamic also applies to this very central thing that we choose to live our lives by, or by which we choose to live our lives correctly. And that is, the greatest commandment is to love one another as I have loved you. Now, Jesus was no psychologist, and maybe it's unfair to take the psychology and what we know or are aware of now and apply it to the phrase. But you look at how he talked about unconditionally taking care of each other. Oh, he came down hard in the way of saying, be compassionate even as God is compassionate to each other. Don't judge and you won't be judged. Forgive and you will be forgiven. Blessed are those who have mercy because mercy will be theirs. You put all those things together in a hopper. And as I ask the question at the end, and I ask this of myself all the time, am I really ready to go on that journey? Because with all the things going on in our world right now, the attitudes of people, the hurts, the insanity, the insensitivity, the harshness, all that stuff challenges what we say, we believe, about our role in the world. Now, if somebody comes into your life, somebody walks into this church, and they obviously are uptight. You know, you've seen people who are very... And they come in and they expect that somehow they're going to be accepted. And we will go out of our way to make sure that they feel accepted on the outside. What happens over a period of time when that person's listening to about being in love and being compassionate and being merciful and all that kind of stuff, and they end up feeling judged by the way we perhaps distance ourselves a little bit, or maybe, you know, we don't pursue any closeness? What goes on in a person's head when I look at them in a disdainful way, as I'm inclined to do, because of something that I see or something that turns me off or something that I know is just I'm not comfortable with? We're living in a world right now where there are so many different categories of people who are right under our noses and for whom there's an awful lot of judgment, condemnation, lack of mercy, no compassion, no forgiveness. Our churches do it. Lisa and I were talking about this just the other day. We talk about this stuff all the time. It's scary. But just the other day we were talking in the car, and she said, you know, I can't believe that, you know, the Catholic Church, and that's where we came from, and, you know, there's, once you're a Catholic, you're really always a Catholic inside, even if you don't buy the church. But the principles of Jesus that were expressed there were ingrained in us as children. And you just don't change that. And it's so hard to see that institution become so outdated, so judgmental, so condemning and exclusive of everybody that's not Catholic, going to church every Sunday, you see me in their Easter duties, and following all the rules. God help you if you're divorced. Or if you happen to be gay. Or you're pregnant as an adolescent. Oh, we have all kinds of help. We'll give you all kinds of support. The judgment is still there. Theologically, it's on the books. You do not belong here. You can't get buried in a Catholic cemetery unless. You cannot be married in a Catholic church unless. Those things have crept into so many areas of our lives that we've become insensitive to what's happening. The things that are happening in Washington right now, I don't get into details, the things that are happening in Washington right now have nothing to do with helping people. We're solving economic power struggles, and the fallout of people is immense. My granddaughter, when she was in third grade, we knew she was in trouble because she was a crusader at third grade when she decided she was going to save the elephants. And she made these little eyes of God thing with, you know, the popsicle sticks with the yarn. And she made 50 or 60 of them and sat outside the grocery store in Middlebury and sold them and sent the money to save the elephants. And she's had various other causes throughout her life. Now she's a freshman in college. She's marching in the gay parade today in New York City because she's got a sense that there is something missing about our humanity. We do not see each other as people. We have gotten used to seeing each other as things, somebody in my way, somebody has to be ignored, somebody to be pushed aside, somebody that has to be competed with, somebody who has got to be less than I am, etc., so we feel better about ourselves. Our whole culture is based on that. Talk about love of one another. Ain't no way it's happening in our country. Racism is still as strong, if not stronger, than it was before the Civil War. I was with somebody just this weekend, and I could not believe what I heard him say. That these black people get all the goods, and we get nothing. All the goods. Whatever they want, they get. They get free food, they get free hospital, they get free. That's racist. That, in instance, they're there, but as a race, my God, some of the most intelligent, wonderful leadership we have in our country comes from the African-American community. One of my dearest friends who visits here periodically was the head of a bank for a number of years, very successful, is on all kinds of boards, has done more charitable work, listening to the Royals last night on TV about all the new things they're doing to raise money for all these different causes. It's like, oh, Calvin is right there. He's right alongside him doing all this kind of stuff, and nobody even knows he's there. Gay friends of mine just had a third child. When they married, it was a shock. Two people in their late 20s, early 30s, met completely by accident, developed a relationship, and kept that relationship alive. Married about 4 years ago, I did the wedding. They now have three children, 5 years ago, they now have three children, a set of twins, and a new youngster, he's like 5 months old. Biologically, one of their children. They are biologically brothers. The happiest group of people, the most loving, caring people in the world. And if one of them went for a job, as he did before they were married, he was labeled as a gay person and lost his job. And it was because he lost his job that he ended up meeting the other guy, and there you go. There's unfairness, there's judgment, there's condemnation. What we don't like, we don't accept, and there's no getting around it. I'm going to come back to my point. Unless we can learn to look at each other and recognize that all of us indeed have baggage, that all of us have somehow been scarred, that all of us have things that maybe we don't want people to know, and maybe even the ones we love the most don't know, that all of us have struggled somewhere. And every one of us would love to know from the world around us that we're okay, that we are lovable, that we are respected, that we get the compassion when we need it, that we have somebody there to support us. In fact, in our world today, you have to pay to have somebody support you. love brings support to have a family like this that knows they're going to be there if you need us. We all know that. We all want that. Everybody out in the world wants the same thing. They may go about it in very different ways. They may break laws. They may do all kinds of things. But they are people who want simply to be respected. Even Vladimir Putin. You know, the demon amongst us. Every human being wants to be treated as a respected human being, without exception. They may not know the words, but that's what they want. And unless and until, brothers and sisters, we begin to open ourselves to the possibility that people are going to come to us seeking what we have to offer as gifts. And they hopefully will expect that we will respond in kind. Then we need to answer this question. How are we going to fulfill the mission? Are we willing to embrace the mission that is ours? Not from the government, not from the state, not even from this church, but from the God who created all of us. Each of us is an experience of God. And whether we believe or don't, whether we are likable or not, whether we fit in or don't, whether we seemingly deserve it or not, every person is a gift, an experience of God. If we can't handle that ideal, then maybe the president of the UCC was wrong, and we don't have what we need and what they're looking for. I would like to suggest that let that be our starting point to where we go from here in terms of what we do here, looking toward the future. How are we going to hear that call? And how will we make it happen? It's just a thought for a Sunday morning. But it's a challenge. I know we can do it. I know we can do it. And we need to stick together to make it happen. Amen.